on a force protection roll while the evidence response team went to work. Vic had spoken to the on-scene supervisor while inbound, citing a slew of legislation passed in the wake of 9/11, so the investigators were sensitive to a national security angle. Having an attorney and a respected and wealthy family on scene didn't hurt either. Vic's phone calls prompted the decision not to alert the media. The last thing that anyone wanted was a bunch of conspiracy theorists from either end of the political spectrum camped out in front of the ranch's gates. One by one, each of the participants gave statements to the investigators, with Cahill ensuring that both the questions and responses were appropriate. One member of the ensemble was conspicuously missing, the quiet, bearded man who had been staying on the ranch for the past month. Crime scene technicians were scattered across the ridges and valley floor, marking, photographing, and cataloging every piece of tangible physical evidence. It was nearly 6 when a black Tahoe pulled up to the ridge. Jonathan and Rafe Hastings watched as a man in tan cargo pants, hiking boots, and a dark fleece jacket emerged, shaking hands with the lead investigator, who pointed him toward the main house. Vic Rodriguez was a Miami native and the son of Cuban exiles. After college, he had served as an Army Special Forces officer before being recruited by the agency where, in the midst of the War on Terror, he achieved a well-earned spot at the top of the CIA's paramilitary food chain. He was the rare Washington animal who was respected by those both above and below him in the chain of command. It was Vic who had seen the potential in Reese and arranged for him to be recruited into Ground Branch in exchange for a pardon of his past transgressions. Vic was in his late 40s with closely cropped graying hair and blue eyes that belied his Castilian heritage. He spoke in broadcast neutral English, yet he could flip to his parents' native tongue mid-sentence. Jonathan and Rafe met him at the door.
"Mr. Rodriguez, welcome to our home. It's not usually this shot up."
"Mr. Hastings," Vic said warmly.
"And you must be Rafe," the agency man said, extending his hand.
Rafe hesitated, then took the outstretched hand. After his experience with a CIA asset in Iraq that had caused his unseasonal departure from the SEAL teams, he was not a fan of intelligence officers.
"Can we get you anything?" Jonathan, ever the host, inquired. "Beer, wine, liquor?"
"No, thank you, I'm fine. Is there a private place we can talk?"
The question was clearly directed at Rafe. The father and son exchanged words in Afrikaans.
"Use my office upstairs," Jonathan offered. "I'm here if I can be of service."
The pair ascended the stairs and took seats in an office off the master bedroom. The walls were adorned with pictures from the Bush War days, and the shelves were packed with books from and about the old country. A monstrous Cape Buffalo shoulder mount extended from one corner, and a full-body leopard mount was situated on the limb of a tree on the opposite wall.
"Mr. Hastings," Vic began.
"Call me Rafe."
"Rafe, as you know, we've cited national security concerns up to this point to keep a lid on this, but that won't hold up for long. I need to talk to Reese, and I need to talk to him now."
Rafe looked the shorter man in the eye and nodded.
"Reese told me you were one of the good ones. He wants to talk to you, too."
Rafe reached across the desk and handed Vic a phone number on scratch paper.
"Dial it from the landline here. It's to a set phone."
"Where is he?"
"He's not far, but he needs a little time. He'll explain."
Vic took the paper.
"Are all members of your family accounted for?"
"Everyone but my sister Hannah. She's in Romania. If you could have someone from the embassy check in on her and bring her in, my family would be grateful."
"That will be my first call," Vic said, standing to switch places with Rafe so he could use the phone. "You and your family did good work today."
"We've had some practice."
True to his word, Vic called Langley. The desk officer immediately contacted the chief of station in Romania. Within the hour, two embassy vehicles were on their way to the town of Moldavia. He then dialed the number Rafe had given him.
"Vic?" Well, Reese, looks like your days of peace and quiet have come to a screeching halt.
Someone had other plans. Your phone call saved our lives.
I can't lose you before I even officially bring you on board.
Yeah. I guess I'll have a harder time saying no next time you ask me to do something.
I'm going to do that now. Where are you?
Close. There was something I had to do before law enforcement arrived.
Please tell me you don't have a live suspect in custody.
If I did have someone, they wouldn't be a suspect. They'd be an enemy combatant. I'll share what I can when I can. In the meantime, I need you to hold off the FBI until I figure this out.
A dead Russian hit team on one of the most respected ranching outfits in the state won't stay secret for long.
What have you found out on your end?
I can only share that with cleared Ground Branch staff.
If I don't get thrown in prison for what I'm about to do, I might be just that. What do you know? Reese pressed.
This morning I received a call from a retired spook from the old days. He was Moscow's station chief near the end of the Cold War, knew your dad. He told me he got a personal call from a Russian intelligence officer named Alexander Zharkov, who warned him of an attack in Montana targeting James Reese and Rafe Hastings.
What? Why would an SVR official want to save my life?
That's the million-dollar question, Reese. I don't know. Zharkov's father is Ivan Zharkov, a Russian mob boss. He runs the Tambov gang out of St. Petersburg.
That fits. The EKIA look like Russian mafia. They're covered in prison ink.
FBI made the same assessment. So, my first instinct is that this is directly related to the intelligence package I gave you last year on Colonel Andrenov.
Reese remembered firing the RPG-32 that turned Vasily Andrenov, a man responsible for manipulating markets with terrorist attacks across Europe and an attempted Russian coup that almost killed the President of the United States, into mulch. Vic, I'm going to have to get back to you. I have work to do.
Chapter 48. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. The full intelligence report on the Hastings family was on Alexander's desk when he arrived that morning. It was more robust than even he would have imagined, with information going back to the 1970s. Soviet intelligence assets had aided insurgencies throughout the world, and the Rhodesian Bush War was no exception. Detailed records of these operations were kept, and many duplicate reports from satellite nations were provided to the Soviets. The result was a treasure trove of information in the SVR's records that spanned nearly a century. The GRU had identified two brothers, Jonathan and Richard Hastings, as members of the elite Selous Scouts, and further identified the family's ranch in the nation's Lowveld as a possible target in years and wars gone by. Jonathan Hastings's name came up again in Angola before he emigrated to the States and fell off the communist intelligence radar. Richard, it appeared, had never left the continent of his birth. The remainder of the information had been gathered from open-source information and by hackers, including biographical, educational, and financial records on the entire family. They had significant land holdings in Montana as well as sizable sums in various investment vehicles. Jonathan Hastings had done very well for himself. He examined the reports for Rafe and Victoria Hastings and found nothing actionable. The final report was for Hannah Hastings. According to her social media profile, she was working in Romania on some type of agricultural project. Alexander's thumb and forefinger sensuously rubbed the human hair bracelet on his desk. Feeling a spark of arousal, he picked up the phone and placed a call. Chapter 49. St. Petersburg, Russia. Gray walked into the office. His steps were slow and heavy, and the gleam in his eyes had been replaced by a dull stare. He had aged over the last 48 hours. Svetlana felt a flicker of empathy for the man, as not all of her affection for Gray was false.
Over the years, she had learned to find some attractive quality in each of her subjects so that she could make the illusion of her attraction to them real. In Gray, she had found intelligence and an almost boyish innocence that brought out her own maternal instincts. Still, his seduction was a job, a way to survive. Her mother had taught her that if she did not look out for herself, no one would. Her mother had been right. The look on her face was one of genuine sympathy when she took his coat and bid him good morning. Gray acted as if she were invisible as he walked into his office and stared blankly at the monitor before him. His plan had failed. Reese was alive, and a dozen of Zharkov's men were presumed dead. His operation had been a complete disaster. If this had happened back at the agency, he would have been ruined, banished to sort mail the remainder of his career. Here, however, he was afraid that he would meet a different end, one that might involve a bullet and a ditch. There was nowhere else for him to run. He would march down to Ivan's office, give him a full report, and throw himself on the mercy of the Pakhan. He asked Svetlana to set the meeting and occupied his time by arranging the documents for the brief. 45 minutes later, he looked at the Rolex on his wrist. It was time. He rose from his desk and marched dutifully toward his judgment. One of the double doors to Ivan's office was partially open, and Gray rapped lightly to announce his presence. The patriarch looked up from a stack of papers on his desk and beckoned the former CIA man inside. To Gray's relief, there was no plastic on the floor and no thugs waiting in the corner to drag him away. The office, half encapsulated in the mirrored glass that made up the building's exterior, was tastefully decorated with relics of Zharkov's travels: a basket of tribal spears in the corner, a Cossack's saber hanging on the wall. The most striking element, though, was the lion. A snarling black-maned cat stood mounted behind Ivan like a guardian, in contrast to the Russian's measured demeanor. It stood for the power of the brotherhood that he led. Ivan could speak softly because there was an army of lions behind him waiting to pounce. He motioned for Gray to sit and offered him tea. Gray politely declined.
Pakhan, I will get right to the point. I have some very bad news to deliver.
Go on.
The operation in the U.S. appears to have met with unexpected resistance. Someone must have warned James Reese of the attack. He stopped just shy of the ambush, turned around, and sped off. Vitya's team pursued him to the Hastings' ranch, but that was the last we heard from them. I cannot reach Dmitri. I fear the worst.
Ivan paused, as if deep in thought. He already knew about the disaster in Montana, but feigned ignorance.
What do you think went wrong, Oliver?
I don't know, sir. It's possible that U.S. intelligence caught wind of it somehow, but I used every method available to avoid their detection. I know how they work. The only plausible explanation is that we were betrayed.
You're saying we have a traitor in our midst?
I don't know. Maybe if we can figure out the why, we will figure out the who. Why would someone in your organization, our organization, want to help Reese?
What do you know about lions, Oliver?
Lions? Gray asked, slightly confused.
Yes, lions. Panthera leo, African lions.
I'm not much of an outdoor person.
Well, I know them, Oliver. I hunted for 21 days before I took this brute behind me in Mozambique. We shot bait animals and chained them up in trees. We waited and waited until his hunger overcame his sense of danger. He was an old male who had been kicked out of the pride to die alone. One day he was the most powerful animal on the block, and the next he had lost all respect. Do you know who did this to him, Oliver?
No, sir.
His son. When a lion's son gets to maturity, he challenges his father for the right to lead the pride. Eventually, this comes to a head and they fight, sometimes to the death. If the father is lucky, he survives, and he limps away to live in solitude for the rest of his days. It's the natural order of things, Oliver.
I don't understand what this has to do with James Reese, sir.
That's because, forgive me for being blunt, you didn't have a father and you don't have a son. It's a struggle as old as mankind itself.
Oliver took a moment to consider the situation and everything the old man had just relayed. Your son, Alexander, is an intelligence officer. He wants to take over the Bratva and would have his own assets embedded in your organization? Gray asked, thinking of Svetlana and finally comprehending the significance of the lions. Could she have betrayed him?
Ivan nodded slowly.
But why? Why would he want James Reese alive?
So that he can hunt him, Oliver.
Chapter 50. Boundary County, Idaho, United States-Canadian border. The albatross circled the lake, its iridescent waters a colder version of Caribbean blue. Officially known as an inholding, Senator Thornton's wilderness retreat was located in a remote section of the Kinicsu National Forest on the border between Idaho and Canada. Privately held from a time before the area was designated a national forest in 1908. Thorne used it as an escape during his years in Congress so his staff could truthfully answer that he was out of the state when he needed a reset. Reese remained in the back of the plane with their prisoner, curiously studying the man he would soon kill. The Russian's head was bagged, his eyes underneath taped over with Rigger's tape. They'd given him 4 oral disc fentanyl wafers for the pain and to knock him out for the flight to a more remote location. Reese's memory flashed back to the chaotic days at the height of the war when enhanced interrogation techniques were the order of the day, and a time when Iraqi units who did not abide by such rules did what came naturally. War brought out the best and worst in one's fellow man. Reese saw the Russian leveling his AK at those he cared about, those who had provided him sanctuary. Katie, Rafe, Annika, Jonathan, Caroline, Thorne. It was his fault. He had been targeted on U.S. soil, and even with all the security precautions in place, they had found him. Reese was going to find out who they were. As the plane began its final approach, he saw the prisoner level his rifle at Katie's head and pull the trigger, her frightened face turning into that of his beautiful wife before being riddled with bullets. Suppressing an urge to choke the life out of the man before him, Reese closed his eyes. Patience, Reese. You need him. As Liz put the plane down with expert precision and floated to a dock, Reese unbuckled his harness and stuck his head into the cockpit.
"How's Khrushchev doing back there?" Liz asked.
"He's still alive. Where's the cabin?"
"You'll be able to see it back in the woods momentarily."
"Beautiful spot," Reese offered.
"Yeah. Thorne usually flies in alone, but every now and again he'll have a guest and I'll ferry them to and from the airport. Make yourself useful and tie us up."
Reese jumped from the side door of the antique aircraft and secured the amphibious bird to the cleats spaced along the mooring. Liz cut the engine and joined her friend on the pier.
"I'll need your help getting him to the cabin, Liz. After that, I want you to come back to the plane and wait. I don't want you to see this."
"Are you forgetting what those savages almost did to me in Iraq? You think I'm squeamish about this? Whatever you are going to do, I can help. These Russian clowns almost killed me and the closest thing we both have to a family. Whoever sent them wanted you and Rafe dead for a reason, and they didn't care who they had to kill to get to you. Whatever you are going to do to this asshole, not only does he deserve it, but it's not you.